And so it's very confusing because when they ask questions, of course, the questions are always put into grammatical form, and the answers must also be put into grammatical form. It's very difficult because they'll say something like, who gets enlightenment? Who meditates? Who is talking to me now? Well, the interrogative pronoun who grammatically requires a substantive to answer it. You've got to say this or it or he or she. There's no other way to respond grammatically in any human speech to that question. So the answer always reinforces the illusion. That's, I guess, why some teachers refuse to answer. They're just silent, or maybe they whack you if you ask that question to somehow break that cycle. One of the most perplexing and off-putting teachings of the Buddha is called the teaching of anatta. An means without, and atta is the Pali version of the Sanskrit word atma, and atma means self, specifically self as thing, particulate self. So the Buddha taught there is no self, anatta. Well, this is totally counterintuitive. It goes against our ordinary ways of thinking. It goes against our perception. It seems not only ridiculous, but an extremely undesirable way of looking at things. But actually, it turns out to be an incredibly empowering way of looking at things. The sense of self as separate, vulnerable particle, that is atta or atma, is a kind of illusion that arises when we can't keep track of things. There's a good metaphor from the physical world for this kind of situation. If I had two kinds of thread, one white and one red, and I tangled them all together and held them at a distance from you, you would get a very clear impression that there was a unified pink mass. As you got closer and closer, though, and viewed more and more carefully, what would happen to pink? What would happen to pink? Well, on one hand, we can say that it would disappear, because when you saw what was really there, you would see red and white, no pink. In the same way, we have this sense of vulnerable, separate, particulate self. When we pay attention to just what is there, the pink goes away. The separate, vulnerable, particulate self perception goes away. And one is left with what? Just red and white. Just feeling body and thinking mind. Of course, one then needs to penetrate and repeat that process. What is the thinking mind? What is the feeling body? And when one scours down into the infrastructure of the thinking mind and the feeling body, one discovers that they have as their nature the vibratory spiritual source of all things. The sense of self as a vulnerable particle goes away when we're able to keep track of just what is there. And then that opens the door to an understanding of the fundamental substance out of which the thought and feeling are constituted. And a new sense of self arises, if we want to call it a self. But it's really not a self in the ordinary sense of the word. Self in the ordinary sense of the word is that pink, and that pink has gone away. The new, quote, self is not a noun. It's a verb. It is the activity of personality that arises effortlessly from the spiritual source moment by moment. And we might refer to that as a fluid self or one's true self. In the Buddhist tradition, they choose to call it the no-self. I know the terminology is very confusing. The trouble is, though, that when we talk about the pink going away, that's not exactly correct. The pink was never there to begin with. A lot of people say, if you practice Buddhist meditation, you lose your ego, or you get rid of the ego in the negative sense of the word. You get rid of the self. And that's not really true. You can't get rid of something that was never there. Basically, you just see things as they are. Just because the sense of self as a thing goes away should not for a moment imply that the activity of personality does not arise within a person. The most enlightened people, the people that constantly talk about no self, have extremely strong, charismatic, impactful personalities. Some people would think that that's paradoxical, but actually it's almost the logical consequence of the experience of, quote, no self. Because the materiality, the sense of self as something material, has gone away. And all the energy that was bound up in that is now freed up for a fluid expression of personality. E equals MC squared. There's a lot of little bits of matter produce tremendous amounts of energy. When one has seen beyond this illusion of the limited self, that really frees up the expression of the personality. In talking about the personality as an activity rather than a thing, I remember something about one of the teachers that has influenced me profoundly, which is Joshu Sasaki Roshi, Japanese Zen master. There's a couple reasons why it's difficult to make progress in meditation without a teacher, although in theory it is possible. Usually we really need somebody to inspire us, to answer our questions, to encourage us to go along. It doesn't have to be that we sort of surrender at the lotus feet of some perfect master. I don't really go for that myself. But I certainly have noticed in my experience that most people make much better progress if they have at least what we might call a coach, somebody to encourage, somebody to answer questions, somebody to work with you who knows your practice. In addition to encouraging and answering questions and sort of taking you through the steps over the months and years, another function that a teacher performs is that they exemplify the practice and help you get over certain fears that you might have about what will be the result of doing this practice. I remember when I had my first interview with this Zen master. He doesn't really speak much English. Fortunately, I speak Japanese quite well, so we literally talk the same language. We come basically from a similar cultural background. We're able to communicate very freely. And the first time I had an interview with him, he communicated very vigorously something that sort of blew my mind. I'm paraphrasing, but in essence he said, "Shinzen, you've been a monk in Japan. You know what this path is about. I'm tired of these wimpy Americans. I expect you to come to the place where you no longer need to make an object of the self or the world ever again." Ring, 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 rings his bell. The words, very carefully chosen. He didn't say, come to the place where you no longer make an object out of the self or the world again. He said, come to the place where you no longer need to make an object out of the self or world again. He didn't say that I wouldn't do it. He just said, you have to come to a place where you don't need to do that. The words, very carefully chosen, very vigorously spoken, and very enigmatic. What does that mean, not make an object out of the self, not make an object out of the world? First of all, what does that mean? And second of all, what would be the consequences of it? Well, what it means is, of course, have such a complete experience of the self in the world that you don't congeal any little piece of that experience into something that is opaque and solidified and therefore an object. I understood what he meant, but what I was afraid of was the consequences of doing that. In essence, it's like telling a person, here's the edge of the Grand Canyon, jump off. Not make an object out of the self and the world. Isn't that more or less equivalent to being dead? And then over the years, I'd observe him. I'd watch very carefully. One of the things about having meditated for many decades is you may not be able to do what the masters do, but you can see what they're doing, just like a really good tennis player may not be able to do what a tennis master does, but they see what the tennis master does very, very clearly. And over the years observing him, I could see by the way he turned his head, by the way he walked, by the way he focused his eyes. When he turned his head, there was no expectation of a world being there. And when he would introspect, gather his thoughts or something, when he would turn inward, you could see by his expression that there was no expectation of any thought as an object inside him. He more or less had the body language of Ray Charles, a blind man, somebody that doesn't expect to see a world. Except, of course, it was in all six senses, not just the visual sense. I could see that as the result of that, he was incredibly happy and incredibly self-expressive and incredibly efficacious in influencing the world around him. I had living proof that nothing bad would happen if I jumped into the Grand Canyon, contrary to all ordinary human ways of thinking of things, if I really was willing to let go of the need to hear sounds as something, to see the world as something, to perceive myself as something, as living proof right then and there that nothing bad comes of that. As I could see he was doing it, the results was good stuff. This is the paradox. When you have so completely experienced your self-consciousness that you don't need to make an object of the self anymore, you might think that that would lead to terrible disorientation. And when you have so fully experienced hearing and seeing the senses in general that you no longer need to make an object of the external world anymore, you might think that that would lead to a kind of bleakness and unhappiness. But I had living proof that that was not the case. In English, when we talk about the experience of self-consciousness, it usually implies something uncomfortable. That's very strange. Why should it? Well, if we look very carefully, we can see the reason that for most people the experience of self-consciousness is uncomfortable is that there is holding or interference with the natural flow pattern of the thoughts and feelings that produce the sense of self. When you can detect the sense of self in terms of its components, moment by moment, you can then allow those thoughts and feelings to arise uninhibited. And when you do so, your subjective experience of who you are becomes wave-like. It's extremely fulfilling in terms of its internal expressiveness. But it's also empty and vacuous because there is no congealing of it moment by moment into a thing. On the other hand, when a person looks at you from the outside, to them it seems like you have an ordinary human personality just magnified or extremely expressive or sort of engaging and charismatic. Both the internal experience of fluidity that you have and the external perceptions that others have of your expressivity, I choose to call this the activity of personality, as opposed to what? The self as a thing or particle. We all have a sense of self. There's nothing wrong with that. The way to come to the experience of no self is not to suppress the thoughts and feelings that produce the sense of self, not to ignore them, but to clarify them. We could in some way say to be a fully self-actualized person is to clarify the sense of self in both meanings of the English word clear. Something becomes clear when it goes from being indistinct to being distinct. On the other hand, something becomes clear when it goes from being opaque to being transparent. These are two very different senses of the English word clear. For most people, the thoughts and feelings that produce the sense of self are very indistinct. There's not clarity about them. They're all tangled together, moment by moment. We're not aware. The sense of self is not clarified in the first meaning. When we clarify the sense of self in the first meaning, we're able to keep track moment by moment of those components and not interfere with those components, thought and feeling, certain thoughts and certain feelings, the self-referential ones. Then the sense of self becomes clarified in the second meaning. It's no longer opaque. It's no longer rigid. It's no longer objectified. It's no longer separate and particulate. It's literally transparent. So that's a clear self. Understanding the relationship between thought and feeling, the feeling body and the thinking mind, is fundamental for understanding how the sense of self arises and also for knowing what to do when the sense of self arises. The same knowledge, the clarity about the feeling thinking process, is also pivotal in understanding the phenomenon that is so major in our human life and so many people have difficulty with, which is the phenomenon of our emotions, particularly our negative emotions, anger, fear, sadness, and so on. Emotions also come about through a tangling together of the feeling body and the thinking mind. If we are able to develop the skills of keeping track of the components, then we will find that the negative emotions become much less negative and eventually stop being negative entirely and return to being part of the effortless flow of nature. Both in terms of working with our sense of self, which after all is at the center of our world, the entire path could be described as a path of self-knowledge in one form or another. Both in terms of working with our sense of self and in terms of working with our emotions, being very clear about what is thought and what is feeling, what is mind and what is body, and their relationship is absolutely fundamental. We have six senses: hearing, seeing, smelling, tasting, the feeling body, and the thinking mind. At any given moment, our experience is composed of some combination of these. Once we realize this, it's very useful because the complexity of human experience is now reduced to the relative simplicity of every experience is a linear combination, A amount of feeling, B amount of thinking, C amount of hearing, D amount of seeing, etc. If we can keep track of the components of the experience as it's happening, we begin the process of deconstructing the experience, of reducing the experience back to the source. To reduce means to lead back, reducere in Latin. Re means back, and ducere means to lead. To reduce means to break something down into its components, something that's very, very complex. We reduce it to a simpler situation. Our human experience is very complex, very perplexing to people. One way to reduce it is to break it down into its sensory components. One can then further break those components down into subcomponents and reduce experience further and further until, after a few steps, we have reduced the experience to the fundamental atoms, which are none other than the vibrations of pure spirit. When those vibrations of pure spirit are allowed to function fully, then time, space, self, and world arise as wave, not as particle. When those fluctuations of pure spirit that are the very substance of our senses are not allowed to arise fully, when they arise with impedance, then space becomes a rigid platform, self becomes a particle, and the cosmos is congealed into separate globs of matter. Our usual paradigm for reality is there is a rigid, always existing framework of space inside which are embedded separate material objects, and within material bodies are contained personalities that are things, also separate and particulate. That's our usual way of looking at things. That's the way that spirit appears when it is expressed incompletely. When it is expressed completely, we get a totally different perception of things. Space is elastic. The cells and objects are vibrations of that elasticity. This somewhat parallels in physics the complementarity between wave and particle. That is a major theme in physics. There's nothing wrong with those fluctuations of pure spirit being expressed incompletely and therefore congealing into time, space, self, and world. Nothing wrong with that. Nothing wrong with the particulate paradigm of things. The only sense in which there's something wrong with that is if that's the only paradigm that we can participate in, then we're missing a very important half of the nature of nature. I once had a conversation with a very highly placed engineer who had actually been responsible for very important projects creating the nuclear submarine fleet of the United States. So obviously, top-notch engineer. And he said something very interesting. He said, engineers find that the wave-particle complementarity is very convenient for them. Because if looking at things in terms of particles doesn't work in a certain application, you can look at them in terms of waves, and that often will work, and vice versa. If the world were only waves or only particles, it would be inconvenient. But the fact that the same world can be looked upon as wave or particle is extremely convenient because different applications require one or the other. And that occurred to me that that is very much like our human life. Certain applications require a temporary congealing of the sense of self as thing, and a temporary congealing of the sense of world as an object. But other applications, other aspects of our human life, don't go very well based on that paradigm. What are examples? Well, if you need to make out your tax form, you're going to have to congeal self and world for a moment. When you drive the car, you have to congeal the self and world at least for a second in order to know what's around you and which way to turn. Then you can let it melt again and go back into the waves of the source, and then recongeal it a second later, just in time to respond to traffic. A liberated person drives their car that way. They go in and out hundreds and hundreds of times in an hour, objectifying and congealing self and world, and then re-merging back into the source, coming out again into the world of separateness, going back into the world of the source, like that. So it depends on the application. When you want to have an experience of God, when you want to merge with another human being, when you want to experience pleasure with lasting satisfaction that also won't turn into neediness, when you need to experience physical and emotional pain without suffering so that it turns into spiritual purification rather than becomes a basis of fear, for all these kinds of applications which come up constantly, these applications, these aspects of human life work incomparably better from the wave paradigm. The problem? Most human beings can't even understand the concepts. What to say of actually make use directly, experientially in their daily life of this other way of looking at things. If you want to have this other way of looking at things, I suppose there would probably be a number of strategies to get there. But one very useful strategy, and I think very contemporary strategy, a strategy that avoids a lot of problems, is the strategy of deal with just what is there, but have such a complete experience of it that you are able to lead it back or reduce it to what is truly there, which is this activity of the source. Now, I should say that when we have this unblocked experience of the six senses and they produce their wave quality, this actually is not the complete experience of the source. There's one final step in the reduction, and that takes place when the waves cancel out and there is a moment of true peace. Not peace in the sense of the mind has stopped thinking, but peace in the sense that all of the expansive and contractive forces that can create this or any universe have come together. And in their coming together, they have drawn the richness of this and all conceivable universes, drawn them back into a state that is a cancellation of positive and negative, so it is a kind of nothing, but contains all positive and negative, so it is at the same time an everything. And that is what St. John of the Cross called todo y nada, or what my teacher, Joshua Sasaki Roshi, calls zero, or what the Jewish mystics called ayin, which is the Hebrew word for nothing. Out of that true peace arises the waves, and within the folds of the waves, like so much foam churned up by the ocean, arises time, space, self, and world. One of the most interesting things to me intellectually that I ever discovered was the fact that the cultivation of high states of concentration is a ubiquitous worldwide phenomenon, and in fact is the common thread that links the mystical core of all of the major spiritual traditions of the world. When I first started to meditate, I practiced meditation for many years in the Buddhist context. At first, my mind wandered like crazy, of course. My teacher had me focus on my breath, and I'd try to bring it back, and it would wander, and I'd try to bring it back. And then I'd be aware that my legs hurt, and I'd try to bring my awareness back to the breath, and then I'd be aware that I was sleepy, and I'd try to bring my awareness back to the breath, and I'd be aware that I was daydreaming, and I'd try to bring my awareness back to the breath. After a period of time, it came back more readily, and I noticed that the voice that usually screams in my ear was a little less imperious, a little less loud, seemed to be fading a bit into the distance. I noticed that the pain in my body seemed to bother me less when I was in that more focused state. My breath would slow down. I started to fall into states of higher concentration, and it was wonderful. I went to my teacher and I said, you know, something really interesting is happening. When I sit, towards the end of the sit, my breath sort of slows down of its own, things get sort of peaceful, and it's easier to have my awareness rest on the breath. He said, oh, that's good. That's very good. You're starting to enter into samadhi. Now, samadhi is a term in the Buddhist tradition that is used in various ways. One of the ways in which it's used is as a general term for any state of concentration, whether light or deep. It's also used in some other ways, more specific ways, which we'll be talking about in a while. I thought, wow, yeah, that's really great. I had studied Buddhism academically. I practically had a PhD in Buddhist studies at that time. I knew how to say samadhi in classical Chinese and in Tibetan, and I knew the derivation of the word from Proto-Indo-European, but I had never experienced it. And now I knew. I had an experiential referent. Oh, this is what I've been reading about in all these books over these years. He said, yes, that's what we call samadhi. Of course, it's just the beginning. Your job now is to vastly deepen it. And then he said something that just totally blew my mind. He said, your job is also to stay in that state all the time, all the time. And I said, I can barely get into that state after sitting for an hour trying, making this Herculean effort to be focused. How could I possibly stay in that state all the time? Well, he was a Zen teacher, and he just said, do it. He didn't explain any details. So I just tried, and eventually I found that I could do it with simpler activities and more complex activities. It took a number of years before I could more or less live with some contact with that state, no matter what I was doing. So this was quite an eye-opener to discover that this was possible, this samadhi experience or high concentration presence could be developed. As that became more and more a central theme of my life, I came to appreciate, you might say, the power of the Buddhist tradition that had this methodology for developing this that anybody could follow. Because, however, I had learned this initially totally within the context of Buddhism in Asia, speaking Asian languages, I originally thought that this was only found in Buddhism. What happened then was interesting. I went to a Zen retreat when everybody was coming in to do this Zen retreat. And, you know, Zen retreats in Japan are pretty tough. I call it samurai boot camp. We're all sitting down, about to begin this 1 week. It's called Sesshin in Japanese, 1 week of intensive training. I noticed that there's another foreigner. And not only is there another foreigner at this retreat, it's a Roman Catholic priest. Well, it turns out this was Father William Johnston. He is an Irish Roman Catholic priest, in fact a Jesuit, who has lived virtually his whole life in Japan as a missionary, but a kind of unusual missionary, you might say a bidirectional missionary. Because when he first came to Japan, he felt that he would never be able to understand the Japanese and therefore propagate Christianity unless he understood the soul of the Japanese people, which he could only understand by having the Zen meditation experience. And this, by the way, I should say, was not unique to him. Most of the Jesuits that I knew that were around him that lived in Tokyo all did Zen meditation. He had already had, say, at least a decade, probably more, of Zen training. And he'd written several books. One was called Christian Zen. Later on, he wrote many other books. Getting to know him was a big eye-opener for me because it turns out that their interest in meditating and learning about Zen was not just to understand the Japanese, but also to recontact something that had been more or less lost within the Christian tradition. That is the whole tradition of concentrative meditation that was developed over many, many centuries in the West. What I learned from this Father Johnston, because eventually we became friends, was that the same state of high concentration, focus with the same physiological concomitants and the same impact on a person's life was a central feature of Christianity until just a few centuries ago. That was mind-boggling for me, because I had no idea that this stuff existed outside of Buddhism. But it was far more than that, because he had a library, his own personal library, in Tokyo, which was a library on worldwide meditation and mysticism. And he let me loose in that library. He let me stay there. Gradually, it dawned on me that the meditative technology, the state of high concentration, was central to all the religious traditions of the world. They all had a mystical or contemplative or meditative core. Suddenly, my work in Buddhism and my own personal experience, which had been so meaningful, was now seen in a much more universal context. So I would say, for me, that was like the discovery of the periodic law of the elements, you know, was for chemistry. It's like suddenly everything falls into place. There's a pattern here that we can see all around the world. It is universal for human beings. In general, there are three aspects to religious or spiritual experience around the world. The vast majority of people have their religious experience centered around concepts, which we could call belief systems, dogmas, faiths, credos. This is, as far as I'm concerned, completely legitimate, but one has to realize this is only one aspect of religious or spiritual experience. But it is the most common one, I guess, because adult human beings are very centered in their thinking process. The spirituality of thought is the usual form of spirituality around the world. That's why most people are pretty fixated in belief systems. That reaches, of course, its extreme in what we might call fundamentalism, which is found in all around the world. A second aspect of spiritual or religious experience, which is the religion of feeling, or the spirituality of feeling, devotion, piety, the heart. Because after all, we're not just thinking creatures, we're also feeling creatures, we human beings. People have a felt sense of what the Romans called the numinous, the mystery, the awesome. They feel love feelings and other kinds of feelings with respect to the spiritual source. A lot of people have their spirituality centered in feeling, and that's called pietism in the West, or bhakti, devotion, in Sanskrit in the East. Of course, you can have a mixture of the religion of feeling and the religion of thinking. At this point in human evolution, most religion and spirituality is centered either in the religion of thinking or the religion of feeling or some combination of those two. However, there is a third kind of spirituality, which is the one that I find most interesting. Typically, the people that participate in this third kind of spirituality, what sets them apart from the spirituality of thought and feeling is that they are familiar with the states of high concentration. Typically through systematic cultivation, but sometimes just through having fallen into it naturally. Now, that third kind of spirituality is definitely at this point in human evolution in the minority. Just because something is in the minority doesn't mean that it might not be extremely important. One might say that it's only a tiny number of human beings that are capable of understanding relativistic quantum physics. But that doesn't mean that relativistic quantum physics isn't very important. This third kind of spirituality has as its hallmark that it is centered around and based on states of extremely high concentration. It is called mysticism. When one practices the path of high concentration, there are many stages that a person goes through. Although some people never go beyond just having states of high concentration, and that's not too shabby, many people use the concentration not as an end in itself, but as a tool. That level of involvement where you have used concentration, your mind has become extremely concentrated, which is wonderful for the mind, and your body has become extremely relaxed, which is blissful for the body. If you continue to grow, the next step takes you beyond the concentrated mind and beyond the blissful body. That experience in the Buddhist tradition is called enlightenment, because with it goes a kind of illumination or profound clarification with respect to the nature of experience, the nature of oneself, the nature of suffering, the nature of fulfillment, the really big fundamental issues. In science, when you crack a fundamental problem, thousands and thousands and thousands of specific applications come out of that one fundamental paradigm shift or insight. And you could call that a kind of illumination, a clarification. E equals mc squared represents an incredible clarification about two of the most fundamental aspects of the universe, energy and matter. So in the same way, the path of meditation ultimately has to go beyond the states of high concentration. Or we might say that the culmination of having cultivated and deepened and broadened the states of concentration, the culmination of that is an experience beyond conditions. The state of concentrated mind is a conditioned state. The state of the body feeling relaxed and good is a conditioned state. There's a step beyond that. That we could refer to as enlightenment. So all around the world, inside every major spiritual tradition, there have been a minority of people that have gotten involved in developing the high states of concentration. A number of those people have gone beyond the high states of concentration to this radical shift in consciousness, radical fundamental paradigm shift, a new understanding about what they are, what the world is, and what God is. So we could refer to that, if we wished, as enlightenment. And if we wanted to call the whole process a process of enlightenment, we could do so. The way I like to use the term, enlightenment is the culmination of the mystical path. The states of concentration are the tool. Of course, it's also a little bit misleading because there's not just one level of enlightenment. You might say that it's like a window opening up that never closes. Over the months and years and decades of your life after your initial enlightenment experience, that window opens wider and wider and wider. And a lot of times people think they're a heck of a lot more enlightened than they really are, maybe for years, until hopefully they either mature or they meet a teacher that can kick them in the pants, show them how much more there is for that window to be open. It was quite mind-boggling for me to come to realize that all over the world and in every historical period, there had been people that shared this experience that had become so significant for me, that lived in the state that I was beginning to live in. And suddenly I felt a link to the mystics of the world, an experiential link, like, wow, this person lived 1,000 years ago here and had a belief system completely different from mine, but I know what this person's experience was. I just went nuts in Father Johnston's library, reading everything that I could about the meditators and the mystics of the world. One theme that becomes very evident is that in each one of the spiritual traditions, there tends to be a generic term for the states of high concentration. There are specific technical terms used to describe different depths or levels of that concentration. And you can actually take the systems and put them side by side and see which corresponds to which across the lines of Christianity, Judaism, Islam, Hindu yogic systems, for example, and Buddhist systems. And it's quite fascinating. Let's start in the West. The most common generic term in Christianity for this was prayer of quiet. It was considered in Christianity anciently, in the Middle Ages, that there were two kinds of prayer. What we now normally mean by the word prayer, which is words and images and maybe feelings in the body, so that's thoughts and feelings about God, right? We talk to God, we think about God, we feel about God. That's what prayer means now. And that's one kind of prayer that was called discursive prayer. The prayer in the nature of a discourse, in other words, a conversation, your mind is discoursing, it's running around. But rather in contrast to that, would be non-discursive prayer, which was called the prayer of quiet, aka what the Buddhists call samadhi. You don't have to have those words and images. You don't even have to have the feelings. You may start with the words and images and the feelings, and then that takes you into a state of very, very deep peace and high concentration. So that's the prayer of quiet. Another word that was used in Christianity is recollection. That's a very interesting word, meaning not to remember, as it does in modern English, but to recollect. In Latin, it would mean, re means back. Col is from con, and it means together. Lect is from legere, and it means to gather. To gather back together, literally, would mean what the word recollection means. In other words, to become concentrated. The mind is scattered, and it becomes recollected. In fact, the Catholic priest is supposed to become recollected. Even if he can't be recollected in his daily life, he is required to be recollected for at least one moment, and that's the moment when he consecrates the host. Of course, that's just one moment of high concentration or recollection. In former times, great numbers of Christians wanted not to have just one moment of recollection, but to be able to live their whole lives in that, because that would lead them to this third and deeper form of spirituality, the mystical experience. If you've ever been to Europe, you know how many monasteries there are. And that's only a small fraction of the number of monasteries that there were at one time, because wars and revolutions of different kinds have destroyed many of the monasteries of Europe. What few people really stop to think about is what function those monasteries played. They were absolutely at the center of the Christian tradition. The monastic movement was started by Saint Benedict, and it was called the Benedictine Rule. And Saint Benedict said that the reason to go into a monastery, why a monastery, and monasteries, of course, if it's for women, it's called a nunnery, but we'll use the word here in a unisex way. Monks and nuns are all monks. The reason to go in a monastery was one and one only, to attain the prayer of quiet. That's what the monastery is for. It's a giant feedback mechanism where your life is simplified and there's basically nothing to do but simple physical activities and other kinds of concentrating activities like chanting and what have you. It was absolutely central to the Christian tradition. Within the Jewish mystical tradition, the general term for state of high concentration is in Hebrew kavanah. It literally means direction. And there was a famous Jewish meditation master who made a statement that absolutely shocked the Jewish world. I like the statement. It's very offensive to certain people. He said, Judaism without kavanah is idolatry. In other words, if you're going to the services and your mind is going here or there, and you're not in a highly focused state, you might as well be an idolater. It exists there within Judaism. In the Islamic tradition, the main way of cultivating the state of high concentration was by chanting and often dancing. The people that did it were called Sufis. That whole activity of dancing and chanting with the goal of developing high concentration is called zikr in Arabic, Z-I-K-R, or in some dialects it's pronounced zikr, D-H-I-K-R. Of course, zikr, or zikr, culminates in a state of concentration so great that you start merging with things. This is true, of course, of anyone that cultivates the path of concentration. Eventually, they get to the unitive experience. The unitive experience was called in Arabic fana, F-A-N-A. There were two kinds of fana. The first was called fana fil sheikh. Sheikh means your teacher, your guru. It's called a sheikh in Arabic. You would merge and, as you were dancing, become your teacher. But then you had to go beyond that to experience fana filah, which means dissolution into Allah, into the source. And there was a oneness with God. The terminology is right there in Islam. In Taoism, the state of high concentration was called a shou yi, which means to hold to the one or to preserve oneness as opposed to scatteredness. Where the technology of concentration is most systematically developed, however, is without a doubt in India. We say that the great genius of Western civilization was to develop a systematic mythology to understand the external world, which we call science. Then the great genius or primary contribution of Indian civilization was to develop a comparable technology to explore and describe the subjective or internal world. India's contribution to the world is that more than any other place on this planet, they really clarified the technology of developing high concentration, the nuances of experience within that, etc. Where you can see this quite clearly is in a work called the Yoga Sutras, which explain in a very compact form the practice of yoga. Now, yoga is one of these technical terms, again, that means different things within different contexts. In any event, the classical yoga system of India is something called Raja Yoga. Raja means king. It's actually related to the Greek word rex. So Raja Yoga is royal yoga. The royal yoga is one of the earliest clear descriptions of the stages of concentration. Raja Yoga is sometimes called Ashtanga Yoga because Ashta means eight and Anga means limb. So it's eight-limbed yoga because they describe the stages in terms of eight steps. The last three steps are the ones that we're interested in because they reveal something about the steps that everybody goes through when they develop states of high concentration. The first is called dharana. That means literally holding. What does that mean? Well, you take some object of focus, could be anything, could be your breath, could be a sound, could be something you visualize, could be a flower, could be your teacher, could be anything. You take some object, you focus your awareness on it. When your awareness wanders, which inevitably it does, you gently bring it back. It wanders again, you gently bring it back. waters again, you gently bring it back. This act of bringing back each time the awareness wanders is called dharana. You're attempting to sort of hold on to the object. In the yoga system, the second stage or level of concentration is called dhyana, D-H-Y-A-N-A. And here's where we get to some confusion, because the same word is used in Buddhism. Dhyana is also used in Buddhism in a very similar but not identical context. Within the context of Raja Yoga, here's what dhyana means. You've paid your dues, you've brought your attention back over and over again to whatever your object of focus is. Now your awareness doesn't wander, but it stays gently rested on that object. The metaphor that's used is that it's like a stream of oil pouring without a gap in the oil. There's an unbroken flow. That's called dhyana. The third stage in the yoga system is called samadhi. Again, we have a possible confusion in terminology here. Because in Buddhism, sometimes samadhi refers to any level of concentration, whether it's dharana, dhyana, or what the Raja Yoga system calls, quote, samadhi. You could get a tremendous confusion. I can imagine an argument between students of yoga and students of Buddhism as to the role of samadhi on the spiritual path, with them never realizing that they were using the same word in a significantly different way. In the Raja Yoga system, the general feature of samadhi is that one not merely has unbroken concentration, but that one becomes the thing concentrated on. Now, that may sound sort of mystical-schmystical, but if you think about it, if you observe your day-to-day experience, whenever you see a flower or are with another person or take a bite of food, your awareness is divided. Part of it flows out into the, quote, object of experience, and part of it flows back into your own thoughts and feelings, the thoughts and feelings that create the sense of yourself observing or interacting with it. So the sense of self versus other comes about because there's a constant division in the flow of our awareness. It goes partially into the so-called other, and at the same time, partially into the thoughts and feelings that create the sense of the self in contrast to the other. Now, I mentioned that at the state of dhyana, the awareness starts to flow continuously into whatever you're focusing on. At the state of samadhi, that phenomenon becomes so pronounced that all of the awareness flows onto the object for a period of time, and none of the awareness flows back into the thoughts and feelings that usually produce the sense of a separate self. What happens then? All there is in the field of consciousness for 5 seconds, 5 minutes, 5 hours, depending on how long you maintain it, all there is the so-called object, which now, however, has become subject. There's nothing else to be but it. This obviously very much changes one's fundamental concepts about what inside and outside are, what oneself is. That in the Hindu Raja Yoga tradition is called samadhi. So that's concentration in the sense of merging or becoming. We might say that it represents a complete experience. However, they distinguish two kinds of samadhi: samadhi with a seed and samadhi without a seed. When you experience merging with something, in the sense of samadhi with a seed, there is just that something, and for a short period of time, as I say, the thoughts and feelings that make the sense of self. However, there is that something as an object shining and filling your consciousness. And it is a thing extended in time and space. There is just flower, or just taste, or just your lover as a thing filling consciousness. And you say, I'm standing in that flower, I am this taste, I am my lover, but as an object.